Hi, everybody, and welcome to I think it's our 58th dissipation of glamour. Glamour, glamour. Oh, that's a good one. Dissipation of glamour webinar. I'm very grateful to those of you who are attending. There had to be a bit of a change of schedule because I'm flying back to Europe tomorrow, and I just haven't worked out how I can do this from an airplane yet, but I'm sure there are ways that it could happen, despite what my neighbors might think. Anyway, we have a little bit more to deal with in kind of a summary way concerning the glamour of fear, which seems to be the great inhibiting force, not just for the human being, but built into the animal kingdom, even into the plant kingdom in a strange recoiling kind of way. Not quite sure about the mineral kingdom yet. It's a rather low level functioning. But this is what we have to overcome, and it's a very lunar type of activity. It has to do with the recoiling. I think Roberto Saggioli called it the repression of the sublime. It's the way that the form nature retreats from the light of the soul and from all the superior lights, as if somehow the nature of that form would be threatened by the application of a superior type of energy. I think that's very true. Every self-contained unit has in it, whether consciously or unconsciously, the instinct for survival. And I think, you know, there's a realization in the form nature of man that that particular form nature will not last in its present condition, and it recoils from the higher energies which will facilitate its disintegration. So there are a few of us here, and somehow you've all managed. It's a little tougher in the United States when we do this, and because I'm out here in Arizona, and I think it's about midnight on the East Coast, about 10 o'clock here, so a little harder for some of the people. But in Europe, I think it's perfectly fine if people are up nice and early. So let us have just a little gathering together. If we can do that, and I want to, let's see, webcam questions, chat. Okay, I might have to ask you, Brett, to, when it comes time to read the questions and so forth, I'm not sure that it's going to show up on my screen. But anyway, so here we are, before our map of the 49 subplanes of the cosmic physical plane, 49 systemic subplanes, and even there are 343, as every one of those cosmic subplanes has 49 lesser subplanes in it. And all of these indicate a change of vibration and consequently a change of consciousness. It's amazing how many grades of consciousness there can be. And I guess we have to admit, you know, we're relatively new to occultism compared to a master. And it is the beginning of our work of ascent into ever higher points of tension, where different types of powers and cities become possible and different penetrations into the realities which are now hidden from our point of view. So here we are. Let us at least imaginatively gather together. And let's see, we've got to have, we've got to, whoever's on, not on mute, let's make sure you're on mute because otherwise we hear stuff. And we want to get the sense of gathering on the mental plane, which is illuminated by this higher light, which is very real, the light of the soul, which we are encouraged to contact in our dissipation of glamour meditation. And so, on the fourth subplane of the mental plane, the factor of discrimination is to be found. And what is that discrimination all about? It's about the difference between the lunar personal self, which consists of 18 subplanes, and the higher self, which is positioned in the higher three subplanes of the mental plane. Now, can we really discriminate those energies? That is the question, and we're going to get better and better at that. So the light of the soul shines upon our minds, and we have a group mind that we're building. And the light of the group soul shines upon this group mind. We're going to understand more and more about group consciousness and how there are really many solar angels of different varieties who are all part of one greater solar angel for each individual, and all of those greater solar angels are part of still greater solar angels. We're talking about the great subject so much found in the Buddhist iconography of emanation. So Sanat Kumara is not the planetary logos, and yet he is the planetary logos. It's all in the mysteries of emanation. And every one of us is deeply submersed in lower and lower vibratory levels due to emanation, and that's where our trouble begins, and we make mistakes, and we become englamored and the victim of illusion. But the Buddha taught us the way, and we learn to detach and abstract and no longer desire that which is impermanent and illusory. So we offer ourselves as that instrument, and we sound an om to confirm it. Well, a little more reading we have to deal with, and we will work on different, there's so many obstacles. You know, the Hydra may have nine heads, but each one of those heads has many aspects. And during the first three initiations, we have to be rid of these factors. We have to overcome them. First, we have to recognize them, and they are the problem with glamour and illusion, too, even more so, perhaps, is that it's invisible, largely invisible to the one who is victimized by it. So, you know, here we are perfectly confident that all is well with our psyche and our method of interpretation, only to discover that later that we've been under the pall of some sort of distortion of truth, some sort of misdirection of desire, some sort of impulsion, which has, I'm talking about Maya now, which has kept us from controlling our energies properly. You know, you've heard of the veil of impulsion, the veil of distortion, and the veil of separation. Those are three of the veils found upon the etheric level. And we have to overcome those tendencies, which are pretty much impulsed from the astral plane and from our desire nature. Basically, we need here a reorientation of our desire nature, which is so often deceptive for us. We find ourselves desiring things which just are no good for the spirit soul. And the Buddha saw that, you know, and he was the one who came to set the desire nature of humanity straight. It's so interesting with his sixth ray mind, very rare phenomenon, that sixth ray mind, but he had a unique perspective on what wrongly oriented desire could do. Some people we have to get rid of desires entirely, but the idea is to have the correct ones, because even the planetary logos and the solar logos, they have their own desire nature. You know, if you find yourself having to get rid of something that will only appear later in the expression of a planetary logos or a solar logos or beyond, then we are invited to examine what we're really doing, because it can be a misinterpretation of what desire really is. Without desire, the whole emanated, fragmented universe would not recombine into wholeness. So, as Moria is telling us as well, desire is very important, but we have to co-measure our desires in relation to the divine plan. All right, so let's see what we have here. We went this far last time, and we talked about methods of eliminating fears. And finally, we ended up with this use of the entire hierarchy, reaching up to the Chohans, the Christ and the Manu, and to the soul, and using the violet light, and simply in the case of emergencies. Now, sometimes it's a little bit flattering. We may think, you know, we're under the attack of some malevolent force, when it's only glamour within us that is deceiving us. But sometimes there are emergencies, and DK tells us that the Black Lodge does war militantly against those who can be of some use. Master Moria tells us to make ourselves useful. Then he goes even further. He says, make yourself indispensable. I've always liked that, and I wonder what it takes. I remember I had an interview with Mary Bailey when I first went to work with the Arcane School, and she was telling me a little story about her husband, Foster Bailey, who was very prominent in the work, and his sort of a humble kind of request was, at least let me be useful. So I think if all of us fasten upon our usefulness in the expression of the divine plan, we'll at least be doing something positive. As for indispensability, well, yeah, I wonder who is indispensable, but maybe there are those who are indispensable at a certain time and place, in certain conditions. The old saying is about indispensability: if you want to see how much you'll be missed, and put your finger in a glass of water and take it out and see what a hole is left due to withdrawal of your finger. But of course, that's a bit of a pessimistic point of view. I think we can work towards a prominent, useful place where we hold our post and do something good in line with the divine plan. It's very simple, and it requires the will, and we can do it. Now, what is said here? Basically, he's telling us that the fear vibration can be faced and can be eliminated. We all have to strive, especially second-rate types, for the vibration of fearlessness, just the way The first ray types have to strive towards the expression of love, which is not the most natural thing for them. The second ray type is, and you know, Master DK's groups are made a lot of second ray types. They're very sensitive, and naturally they respond to the fear vibration very strongly. We don't want that to be the case for us, and so we have to be courageous in facing what hidden fears we may have, because it's not the obvious fears that are the danger. It's the ones that we don't know about and that are working within our psyche. Those are the dangerous ones. So he says, fears fall into two categories for the worker. Notice, you know, the worker is not just the interested aspirant, curious, and so forth. The worker is someone, a real disciple, using the will, using the mind. Excuse me. Fear of what the future holds, and secondly, doubt as to the outcome of any effort. There is a Rurik painting which shows a saint in prayer, and you know, he looks like he's really quite in transcendental contact with some beautiful higher source. But if you look down at his foot and his heel, there's a tiny black serpent, which is called the serpent of doubt. And it can undermine the whole effort. So our conviction as to the reality of the hierarchy, the reality of the divine plan, the reality of the assured outcome, eventually, of the divine plan. These are things we really have to cultivate and not let any creeping doubt undermine our efforts. So fear of what the future holds, and secondly, doubt as to the outcome of any effort. With most people, it is a combination of the two. You know, just pause for a second, you know, there's so many economic worries now in the world. I'm sure many people are economically worried. Not just, well, they've been worried about rampant armies destroying their lives and the lives of those next to them, but those kinds of things. What does the future hold, especially if you're in an unsafe place, an unsafe country? DK distinguishes between the safe countries and those in which war occurs. Right now, if most of us as Western people, we do not live where active war is occurring, at least not on the outer and physical plane. So, you know, what? Think about your future. Is there any... Is there any phantom there that is lurking that indicates a fear? See, we can't really determine the future on any large scale, and some things are completely out of the hands of the human beings that whose job it is simply to suffer from the larger decisions of superior forces. If you turn to page 384 in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, he details the result of the crucifixion being experienced on our planetary globe and chain. And it's our task as tiny little cells and units, our task is to suffer through that. But suffering somehow brings greater sensitivity and brings the light on this planet of releasing sorrow and purifying pain. And, you know, will it all work out? Well, of course it'll all work out. It's just a question of the timing and how much pain. On this most painful of all planets, as DK tells us, how much pain are we willing to endure? A lot of people say, well, you know, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. They say that, but I don't think it goes along with the ageless wisdom so well. With most people, it's a combination of the two. Most aspirants have no basic doubt as to the ultimate issue. But they do doubt at times the working out of those issues in the present time. See, we don't want to endure too much of this unpleasantness, we might say, which keeps us away from harmony and beauty and joy and all those kinds of things. But really, joy is not dependent. Real joy is not dependent on whether there is pain operative. Some of the great, great souls, I'm thinking of Ramana Maharshi, I'm thinking of Gandhi also, somehow they endured great pain and they were able to keep their consciousness detached so that in their consciousness was the joy, regardless of whether the pain was also being experienced. So no doubt as to the ultimate issue, but they do at times doubt the working out of those issues in the present time, and they shrink back. Now, those are the operative words regarding fear. When you find yourself shrinking back from something you know you ought to do for fear of, you know, then there's an indication of something that has to be overcome. And they shrink back also from the path of endeavor, knowing, and rightly knowing that it leads through trial and loneliness to the feet of the Hierophant. So the illusion of loneliness, the illusion of the trial, the way of the lonely ones, it was a book by Manly Palmer Hall, a great soul. And the illusion of loneliness comes down upon us. You'll read about that when you read about the blessed ones who really are the monad in incarnation. So trial and loneliness, you know, and there's no other way, really. There's no other way, because we cannot be dependent upon anything outer. Our dependency is upon our own self. So that's why the Buddha, in his last sermon, preached something that sounds so ordinary, but in a spiritual sense, it's extraordinary. He preached about self, what can we call it? Self-confidence, self-reliance, rely upon yourselves. Well, but what is the self? The self is the monad itself and beyond. So he's saying rely upon the greatest spiritual factor within yourself. And even though there is the illusion of loneliness, you will pass through it into the all-oneness. I like to think of that as an alternative way of pronouncing aloneness, the all-oneness. Okay, and further, they, people like ourselves perhaps, are likewise distressed. Now think about this. Likewise distressed by troubles and high vibrations which seem to emanate from spiritual sources. You know, when Krishnamurti was being tuned up so he could respond to the vibration of the Christ, an experiment was made there. He went through agonies to get his vehicle in the shape that it had to be to withstand the presence of the Christ. We sometimes say, oh, you know, Christ, walk into my room and, you know, bless me or make me fit and all the rest of it. But their vibration is so high and our integration is so low that so many adjustments have to be made. So distress comes this way too, from high and beautiful things. As DK says, when you're in the presence of a master or some very high soul, they disturb you. They create a situation where you may feel great distress and anxiety and incapability. So we don't want to romanticize the whole business of contacting the great ones. Often the great ones have to hold back the full power of what they are so as not to unduly upset the integration of those they seek to help. Strong vibrations will come with ever increasing frequency, and as the race progresses in evolution, the vibrations will wax stronger, and the reactions, when we will react, you know, because the lunar nature within us will react, the reactions must be dealt with in wisdom. So it's not just the evil things which are causing us the problem of fear. They do exist. But the high things, too, cause this problem of upsetting. It's always amusing, you know, the Buddha predicts that he who is Confucius, who is now a master, okay, will be returning to China. And he didn't give the timeline, okay? And he says, and he will create a disturbance. You know, and then DK elaborates on the idea of disturbance that, you know, to the soul it may seem to be a passing adjustment, and the personality may consider this disturbance to be of an appalling nature. So obviously the great ones look at things a little bit differently than we do, we who are so attached to form. Let's go on a little bit more, I would say. Yes, a little bit more. Excuse me. Two things manifest when spiritual vibration is exceedingly potent. Okay, so all good aspirations and synchronous high vibrations are stimulated by the presence of these high energies. And secondly, all that we term evil is likewise stimulated. I wonder if any of us have had that experience. I know I've had it. You know, you get into this field and the great energies begin to really make an impact. And the next thing you know, you're into a plutonic experience where all the stuff that's been hiding in the bottom of your aura, so to speak, is dredged up and thrown in your face. And you see that, well, you may not be as pure as you thought. You know, there's all kinds of stuff hiding there. And, you know, good evokes evil. It calls it forth. That's in the esoteric healing rules and laws. And it's near the end. So we have to be prepared for the idea that when we are subjected to the good, it's not just a pleasant experience. We really begin to see ourselves and the things that we have hidden from ourselves. Aspirants should bear this carefully in mind. There may demonstrate such a factor as a crime wave, but there will also demonstrate an increasing number of groups that stand for spiritual endeavor and high aspiration. I think it was Swami Vivekananda. He was taking the fourth initiation, I believe, and he went into this thing called the Shiva ice cave. I don't, you know, I think there's some sort of ice statue of Shiva in this, and very, very cold. And he emerged with the sense, you know, having a lot of fourth ray himself, he emerged with the sense that there was no way to avoid the polarities in our life on Earth. And that evil was as much a part of things as good was in our present situation. And that is, you know, quite a realization for people who are undergoing an initiation on the ray of harmony through conflict, which the fourth initiation actually is, no matter what your ray may be. So there may demonstrate the crime wave or some higher thing simultaneously. The effect of the heightening of the vibration on you, that's us, the aspirant, may manifest in various ways also. So, you know, we're kind of wondering, you know, how it is we live and what's the cause of it, and how it can be that when we contact these high energies, things that don't seem to be very high are coming into manifestation. So the effect of the heightening of vibration, how does it manifest in our life? And he says here, it may result in bodily fatigue, and this must be dealt with, not so much by sleep and by rest, though a just proportion of them is necessary, but above all, interestingly enough, by a change of vibration, of recreation, and of amusement. Isn't that interesting? Now, Master Moria is very interesting because he doesn't say rest is going to sleep. He says rest is a change of labor. You've heard that. And the DK seems to be saying the same thing. So, you know, there's the old Gemini approach when things seem very dull and you're about ready to collapse. Do something quite different, which is recreational and which summons the muse, you might say. Now, what else might happen as a result of this being subjected to very high vibration? Secondly, it results frequently in a profound depression. Now, isn't that interesting? You would think that would be the very opposite when you contact the high spiritual vibrations. In an utter sinking of the heart as the future is faced. Now, why would that be? You know, because we know we have that built-in inferiority complex. So many people on the second ray seem to have it. Profound depression as you find your equipment to be inadequate and the task so very demanding. But he says, face that future, however, and remember that what the future holds is not revealed, but the joy cometh in the morning. And it's a marvelous idea. And it seems to suggest that we have to pass through the dark night before the real joy comes. It results also in a sensitiveness, another thing, drawback apparently, of the astral body that is perhaps even more hard to bear. This must be dealt with by the individual as best he may, bearing in mind the suggestion that I've given him, suggestions about how to overcome the fear and how to wisely use the high vibrations at an increasing point of tension. It results also in a permanent stimulation of the atoms in the various vehicles and their coherent, stabilized vibration. This is the positive stuff. It lifts a little nearer to the goal, though perhaps the aspirant may not realize it. So there's this great requirement of faith on the path. We've been given a great teaching. It makes sense. It's logical. It is tested over the ages. It is sanctioned by the hierarchy. It's sanctioned by the Christ. It's sanctioned by Sanat Kumara. And if we don't know every little bit about it, okay. We stay with it with utter faith, and joy will come in the morning. But we have to be willing to pass through the various dark nights of the soul. It's quite inevitable. Well, I'm not going to go on anymore because, you know, he's just, DK is giving us a real wonderful pep talk here, if I may say it. He's so inspirational. And he himself, I think, you know, had a lot of the sixth ray. He was known as a very zealous disciple, you know, so much so that the masters really remarked upon it. About his great zeal. Okay, so this will be the end of Dissipation of Glamour, webinar number 58, reading. And let's see now. This is the 30th of November, and it'll be the 7th of December before we... So this is the 30th of November, and we'll continue... Continuing on number 59, on the 7th of December, 2017. I should really learn how to spell here, you know. Anyway, continuing. So, you know, one of the most practical of all books, A Treatise on White Magic and How Well It Dovetails In With the Glamour work. I mean, we're being trained as disciples, not just theoretical disciples, not just people who know a little something about something because we've heard it said and then we repeat it, but people who can actually do what is suggested. So I'll tell you what, before we have our meditation on overcoming the fear in general and our willingness to pass through the dark night of the soul, which occurs around the second initiation, around the fourth initiation, around the sixth initiation, although then it's not the soul, more like the dark night of the monad, and around the ninth initiation, these various dark nights occur, where with faith we have to accept occult blindness, which has been thrown upon us as a protection. The soul itself throws the blindness, the veil, upon the advancing aspirants, so the progress is not superficial, but made with some degree of depth. We have to trust a lot. We're in good hands, and that little serpent of doubt, you know, we cannot allow that to undermine our efforts. We have to be substantially en rapport with the very thing that we do not yet see. But it's there, and we will enter into it and be fully cognizant of it and be able to wield the energies which come from living at a higher point of tension. But I cannot really overestimate the value of faith in this process. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen, and faith and light are very much together. DK says an even more esoteric interpretation is that light is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things unseen. So now I'll turn it over to, if there are any questions. Like I say, I don't know if I'm going to be able to see these, but Brett will give me a hand here. And, you know, I guess there are three of us sponsoring this, Olivia, Tuya, and myself, and we welcome your thoughts. We somehow realize how important it is to deglamorize the thinking process of humanity, which at the moment reeks of glamour and has so many distortions, and at least we who are aspirants and disciples, we've got to clear it out of our own aura and out of our own groups so we can stand on the inner planes during these next 7-8 years in the final era of the Forerunner, when so much will be decided based upon whether humanity decides wisely and bravely or not. Okay, is there anybody who has any questions, any comments? Yes.
We have a couple of comments from Suzanne and Walter in the written section.
Okay. Actually, I was able to get it. Okay. I tremble on the brink of the abyss, fearing pain, yet fearing more so bliss. That's amazing. Who is the author? Are you the author, or it sounds, you know, it's very good. And of course, this is the repression of the sublime. Roberto Saggioli writes about this, and whoever it was that helped Nelson Mandela write that famous speech, they talked about the fear of our own greatness even more than the fear of our negativities. So, because so much will be demanded of us if we really admit to our inner potentials. And what will be asked, you know, as T.S. Eliot says, not less than everything will be asked. Not less than everything. When you remove your finger from a glass of water, the level of the water as a whole drops somewhat. Okay, well, that's a good way of looking at it. If we as individuals try to think we're the entire glass of water, then we may feel disappointed. I like it. However, if the water glass is seen as a group endeavor, with many fingers in the glass at once, then we can see the right proportion, see in right proportion our individual and collective contributions. Okay, I like the way of looking at that, I guess, the lower ego tends to make one feel falsely indispensable. You hear politicians and demagogues these days say, "Only I can do this. If you want the solution, only I know," and all the rest of it. And it's just the little lower ego blasting forth without any depth of soul. So we certainly want to avoid that cramped identity which comes when we think that we are the personality. We really have to detach. But I like the idea, Walter, and thank you. Suzanne, yes, my muse helped. The muse is that quality of inspiration that we all carry, it's rather interesting. Artists, oftentimes, they may not feel inspired on a cold Monday morning. I remember my composition teacher telling me, "Well, Beethoven had some bad days. Did you ever hear his Battle Symphony?" In other words, your inspiration leaves you. It seems, so it seems. But then the muse appears, and the muse connects you with the source of inspiration. Sounds very Venusian in a way. And whatever kind of creativity we may be involved with, the muse is a bit like the Antikorana, which connects us with the source of inspiration. Okay, so it's Marianne Williamson, right? Olivia, thank you for that. Yeah, that's the whole idea of greatness. And normally we would say, "Well, I'm not afraid of my greatness; I can handle that." But we do have to account for this very real psychological dynamic called the repression of the sublime. Let's call it like this: the flight from the light, if I may call it that, running away from illumination. And we say, "Oh, I would never do that. I would go deeper and deeper into the light." But then, when push comes to shove, and the light is very, very great, and maybe even blinding, whatever, it's not such an unusual reaction to, for our form nature, if we're identified with it, to recoil from the greater light. Or we say, "Oh, it's too much for me. Oh, I can't stand the intensity," and all the rest of it. So, let us be aware of those things. Thank you for your offerings, everybody there. And let's see, is there now? Let's see.
Yes,
Yes.
Suzanne has her hand up.
Okay, Suzanne, did you want to speak? I mean, if you do, I mean, I can easily take you off mute here. Because usually, yes. Suzanne, did you want to say something?
Oh, I apologize. I you had asked who had written the poem, and I just wrote it. It's from one of the ones that I have written. I'm sorry, I forgot to lower my hand.
So who is the author? Who is the author?
From one that I wrote, Michael.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Okay. Well, it captures it. I thought you said Wordsworth, and I was about ready to believe you. Well, that's it. It's very somehow it captures something. You
Well,
know, it,
I was off. If I can find it, I'll send it on to you.
very good. I'm sure we'd all enjoy that. Yet fearing more so bliss, abyss and bliss. These are great apparent contradictions, but they hold a great truth. And when you read the story of the blessed ones, I've referred to that quite a bit in esoteric psychology too, right in the 30s of that book or somewhere in there. He deals with what we all go through as spirits returning to the highest state from which we left on our pilgrimage. And there's a lot of stuff we have to go through. But it ends with the idea that nothing remains but bliss. As a matter of fact, if I can, what I would do is, let's see, what would I do? I'll pull this down, and that would be esoteric psychology two, and let's see if nothing remains but bliss. bless bliss. Okay, not bless, but bliss, although they are related. All right, got it. I've got one. Okay, so, naught disappears but pain. Nothing remains but bliss. The bliss of knowledge true, of contact real, of light divine, the way to God. This is the section right in the early 30s. I read it often because it's so universal. It tells what we all pass through. And, you know, I just think it's a great strengthener for all of us. So if you want to send that along, Suzanne, that'd be great. Appreciate that. Thank you so much. Now, let's see. Let's see what else we have. Brett, what are you suggesting? Anything? Anybody? Suzanne? Olivia? Okay. And Olivia offered that. Yeah. Marianne Williamson? Yeah. Okay, good. You know, there's so many. In Agni Yoga, it tells us that whenever the energy level of a leader is about to become rampant or dangerously strong, a moderating influence is attached to that leader. Well, you know, normally we would look at Nelson Mandela and we would say, well, the relationship with Bishop Tutu was really important. And we're also told about George Washington and how a particular professor was attached to him. You know, obviously a difference in rays. These are these great first-ray types, and oftentimes the attachment comes in on the second ray and third ray just as a moderating influence. So this is the role of the advisor, the chamberlain, the one who sees things a little differently than on the first ray, and a very necessary combination along with this first-ray power. I'm sure there are many examples of it, and Moria brings that to our attention. Okay. Okay, Suzanne, Walter. Okay, Olivia. Okay. Is there anybody else who would like to say anything at this point or ask anything? Or excuse me. Before we get into our meditation. You know, DK has written one big book, as far as I'm concerned, one huge book, which demands what I call a spherical study, you know, linking up everything. It's a Mercury thing, and he's much associated with the planet Mercury. You link up so many things via Mercury that you're left with the wholeness of Jupiter. So it doesn't make any difference what we study. We can get to any place from any place. And all things aspect, all aspects of wisdom aspect each other and shed light upon each other until we get this great sphere of light. And that's what we're all heading into, so that the statement, I see the greatest light, proves true for us. You know, we do have coming up the Sagittarius full moon. I think on the GMT night of the 2nd, Francis Donald will be doing the meditation, pre-full moon meditation. I'll be up in the air somewhere over, you know, the Atlantic Ocean or England or whatever. And then we have a special thing. Tuya and I are both going to be traveling, and Tuya will be preparing the exact full moon meditation beforehand, and Brett will broadcast that in such a way that Tuya's meditation synchronizes with the exact moment of the full moon. So I think, Brett, do you have any of those things in the chat box, any of the links?
I just put them there.
Okay, excellent. All right, so please do join the group for that. Appreciate that. We're with you. We'll be meditating with you, even though we cannot be near a computer. And Francis will handle everything beautifully for the pre-full moon. He knows a lot about astrology, and he always does a great job. So So we look forward to working with you on this sign of the future, which leads to vision and revelation, which we really need at this time. Okay, anybody else that would like to say anything or before we get into our meditation? Okay. Right. Thank you. All right. Anyway, read this wonderful thing about the Blessed Ones in Esoteric Psychology 2. Oh, it's just wonderful. The Blessed Ones are not, and yet they are. The Blessed Ones know not, yet know all. The Blessed Ones love not, yet offer love divine. The Blessed Ones remember not, yet all is recollection. The Blessed Ones remain in isolation pure, and yet at will can take a form. The Blessed Ones dwell ever in the high place, in the high and lofty place, yet oft can walk on earth in light phenomenal. The Blessed Ones manifest not through forms, yet are all forms and all intents. And, you know, really, when you get down to it, you find out that the Blessed Ones are the monads, and they are the monads especially in extension in the lower worlds. Each one of us is ultimately the Blessed One, and we have to get to the point where we really realize that to be the case. Well, you know, we're on our way, and we will make the grade. May take a little of what we call time, but we will make the grade. Okay. So let's go on to our meditation. Excuse me. The air in Phoenix is getting me just a little bit. The pure air of Finland is a little more suitable to somebody with Saturn and Gemini the way I have it. So, but I may be leaving just in time and and get that dose of pure air quite soon. All right, here we go. So we begin there are some 29 of us here, a lot from Europe now for this one, and Australia, New Zealand. And we hold for a little while the silence, strengthening ourselves in the silence. And I think we can feel the coming together of the group on the subtle planes. Silence and synthesis are so closely related. And in the silence, the synthesis can be sensed. Then we're going to work with the Divine Cross, as he calls it, the cross of divinity. And we make that cross, including the eyes, as you know. So this is our protection, and we do not act arrogantly as if we don't need it. We do need it. As a soul, I work in light. and darkness cannot touch me. I take my stand within the light. I work, and from that point, I never move. We see the radiation of the light that this particular cross, the cross of divinity, which is a protection for us and a protection for the group. Then we think of the three lights. We draw up the light of matter to the mental plane. Especially the etheric physical light, we draw it up. And then we have the light of mind on the lower mental plane. And we imagine the blending of these two lights. And we have the two as one now. And we think of soul light now. We try to touch that meditatively. We recognize that, in a way, above the head, the soul light exists. We really do want to penetrate into that light of the soul until it becomes, for us, a reality. And we bring it down as a light and fuse, we imaginatively fuse this soul light with the two other lights of matter and of mind. And now it is as if three lights are one light. And then with this image of the three as one, we say together, the light is one, and in that light shall we see light. This is the light that turns the darkness into day. As always, the lesser light can fulfill its function of revealing a greater light, and it's eventually the light of the intuition which can have such a transformative effect upon the personality that we want to reveal. To get the astral body and the intuitive vehicle en rapport with each other. Now, we use the formula, standing midway between the high worlds and the worlds of glamour. And we're going to, as we do this, we kind of turn on, imaginatively turn on the great searchlight that we have created, made of the three lights, and it's a group light made of the many individual lights, and we see it out onto the astral plane. So we visualize the following as we see that great light pouring out onto the astral plane, where we will use it as a point of revelation, as a weapon, as a method of dispersal. We say, radiance are we and power. We stand forever with our hands stretched out, linking the heavens and the earth, the inner world of meaning and the subtle world of glamour. We are the bridge, and the world of meaning is the world of the soul, and the world of glamour is the world of the astral plane. The true soul really is the spiritual triad. We have been told that. So we think of ourselves as the bridge, linking the inner world and the outer lower world. Now the second part here, we reach into the light and bring it down to meet the need. We reach into the silent place and bring from thence the gift of understanding. Thus, with the light we work and turn the darkness into day. DK clarifies our mind about the astral plane. It's not a place of great light. It's a place of darkness in many ways, and confusion and distortion. And it must be clarified. So we see our beam of light out there, in there, on the astral plane, ready to do its work with the fogs, the miasms, the veils. Subtle internal work, but over time effective in the outer world. So then we're going to add our spiritual will to this beam to make sure that it is the strongest method of revelation, the strongest weapon, the strongest factor of dissipation that we can make it. And so we say this little mantra about the spiritual will, visualizing it in relation to the beam, with power upon its beam, the light is focused on the goal. So we are responsible together for this beam and its effectiveness in clearing the way. We're dealing with fear, and the glamour of fear is named, and the light is thrown upon it. And these words of power back up our process. And as we pronounce the words of power, we're going to penetrate the glamour, and we're going to produce its weakening and its dissipation. So make sure we have a good beam going, strong, clear, for which we are responsible. A triple light of soul, of mind, of matter, bringing light, a great sun, to the astral plane. And so, the words of power, the power of our united light prevents the appearance of the glamour of fear. Clear of fear. The power of our united light negates the quality of the glamour of fear from affecting humanity. And this quality we know is one of, for want of better words, shrinking back. Shrinking back. That quality is not allowed to affect humanity. Then the quality, the power of our united light destroys the life behind the glamour of fear. The vitality no longer supports the glamour of fear. So we will use these words of power in the silence. You work with them how you wish to work with them. And in these moments of silence, we will see this glamour weakening, and we'll see it being dissipated. So we begin to work 5 minutes of purposeful and intense silence. We find that the great sun of fearlessness shines forth on the astral plane, and fear no longer can take root in our individual lives, in our group life. We are the immortal God within, and we have, as DK suggests, confidence in the immortal God within. It's a slow process, because over millions of years these wrong reactions have been built up based on the incorrect apprehension of what we really are. But we will overcome that which causes us to shrink back into the darkness, and instead we will expand in the light, characterized by the quality of fearlessness, regardless of any circumstances. And so we withdraw our beam from the astral plane. We temporarily shut off our search light, as he calls it, the search light of the soul, temporarily. And with the faith that something of value has been done, working together as we do, we sound the Om 3 times. Basically, friends, we are trying to make ourselves into more fit instruments to be of use to the hierarchy in executing the divine plan in the place where we find ourselves. It's very practical work, and so much of what the Tibetan has written touches upon this practical work. We're going to learn to really work from the inside out. You know, we're people like ourselves, we're not in the legislatures, we're not in the courts, we're not in the leadership and executive branches of government, but we are allied with the inner government of the world. And our task is to really learn how to work inwardly. Now, just think how Master DK and such masters have influenced our lives, and yet, you know, they've never walked into our room, so to speak, as Alice Bailey had Master K.H. walk into her room one fine Sunday morning. And yet, from the inside, they've been tremendously influential. And thus, we, in our group forms, will learn also to be influential. Now, let's see, today is the first, where a lot of you are. It's the 30th here at the end. In most of the United States, it's the 1st of December, almost so. On the 2nd, as I said, there's the pre-full moon, which is 8 p.m. GMT, and Francis Donald will be offering that. And the next day, let's see, what time is our actual full moon there, Brett? Do you see somewhere? Does it tell us? I can find it in the somewhere. Yeah. 3:46 and 54 seconds Universal Time GMT. And that's on the 3rd, right? So like I say, Tuya will be preparing a meditation. Yes. And Brett will, with his mathematical ability, be calculating it so it all works out right. And we'll be with you. We'll be with you in meditation together, wherever we happen to be. And I'm not sure, let's see, whether we are, Tuya, are we doing the Soul of Nations on Saturday? No, Saturday evening, huh? Maybe, I don't know. It's up to, let's see, Saturday evening is the 2nd, isn't it? So we don't want to collide with Francis. But if we worked at 8 o'clock, we might be able to do it. So anyway, I'll leave that to you, whether we're going to do that or not. I'll just be arriving shortly after in Helsinki. And yeah, so go ahead, Tuya.
Yes.
But you've got to unmute yourself in order for me to be able to... So you've got to unmute yourself, Tuya. Can you do that? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, is this now?
Yep, you're good?
Okay, no, we are not doing the Soul of Nations.
Okay, okay.
Because there are the same, there are too many.
Too many things going on. Too many things. We'll concentrate on the full moons. We'll concentrate on that.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. All right, friends, thank you very much for joining us. We will persist in this work, which will make us stronger subjective workers. And, you know, in these latter days of the Forerunner, we have to rely upon our esoteric abilities, not just our outer abilities, but our group esoteric abilities. We'll be talking a lot more about that and about cultivating those things. Like Master Moria says, half the world thinks and the other half carries out their thought. Well, you know, esoterically, it's not half, but a lot of people are carrying out the positive thoughts of the thinkers on the subtle planes. So Brett will get this ready for you to go to Makara, and lots of love and many blessings from all of us here, Olivia, Tuya, and myself, and to everybody. Many blessings, and we'll be working with you. I see the goal, I reach that goal, and then I see another. Talk to you later. All the best. Bye-bye.